A Tapestry of Discovery, the interactions between government and industry in the research and development of electronic materials and devices from 1945 to 1970. A 55-minute presentation to the Defence Electronics History Society held at the Defence Academy Shrivenham on the 18th of October 2007. The speaker is Professor Cyril Hilsum.
Right, well, I'm going to talk about electronics, materials and devices, R&D, a subject which I think has been pretty much neglected in your proceedings so far. And let's set the scene in September 45. History is much more than a catalogue of events. Certainly we have to set out what's happened, but we'd like to know, as well as what, why, and also how. And that brings in the people. So you will find that I bring in quite a lot about the people that were involved as well as the events. So you want to know, why should I be doing this? Well, I was there as a witness. I can't say my colleagues would say I'm an unbiased witness, but I am a witness. And I will apologise in advance for bringing in my own name quite often. So let's see where it started. And it started with me getting this letter from the Admiralty. I should say that I had already been subject to an interview by C.P. Snow and Harry Hoff, some of you may also have met, who had decided that I would not stay on at UCL and do a PhD, though the war was over, but I was needed at ASE to do some work in antennas. And I have to say that although the Japanese gave up at that stage, it probably wasn't because of me. The rest of the letter went on to say that as a result, I should report to Admiralty headquarters and really start working on infrared, which I did. Now, the Admiralty had responsibility for all three services for infrared research during the war. And they'd done pretty well, actually. The first thing that they brought out was a simple image converter tube. I say simple because it's just an anode and a cathode, basically, and the rest is there so you can get a decent vacuum and put some cesium in. It was made at EMI, and so was created the RG tube, RG being short for radiogram, which presumably was a code word so nobody knew where it was being made. Image converters were also made in Germany and the US, but as you can see, the design was much more complicated. They were better tubes, but they were much more difficult to manufacture. And as a result, infrared was hardly used by either of them as near infrared during the war. In contrast, we made thousands and thousands of the simple RG tube and also put it in these handheld receivers. The handle is also the power supply, which is a series of Zamboni piles giving you 2 kV. And never needing to be changed. That works only at very small current, but of course the tube only needed a very small current. The system was used for night driving. It was also used for recovering agents when they were abroad. You simply had a beacon or you had just a corner cube and you could see where they were. ARL was also interested in ship detection, and they got interested towards the end of the war in using and developing photoconductive cells based on lead sulfide. We were a bit surprised to discover after the war how much work the Germans had done on infrared. In fact, you can see this rather large optical system called the Donaugerät, which had a bolometer at the focus. This was put on the Cherbourg Peninsula to see if they could detect ships. They were rather surprised to discover that they had detected quite a lot of ships coming at them. But the commander said, well, that's the noise that we've been seeing for weeks before you claimed you got rid of it. Well, those reports coming from Germany after the war stimulated defence interest in infrared, and ARL and TRE jointly mounted an important programme on atmospheric transmission of the infrared. And they showed, quite surprisingly, that there was a very good window between 3.4 and 4 microns. Now, that is quite interesting. It's a bit awkward. It's slightly beyond the glass cutoff. But you can see it's a better window than the one that had previously been supposed to be the best, around about 2.7 microns. Clearly, then, we wanted a material that would actually detect radiation in that window, and lead sulfide couldn't quite get there. Lead sulfide died at about 2.7 microns. So at ARL, they started some work on lead selenide. They did some work on PBS still and had a contract with BTH in Rugby. The mainstay of the group actually was a Polish scientist. I never knew how he got there. They had a lot of Poles at ARL when I joined. But there was a scientist called George Jacek Starkiewicz, who was an expert in making evaporated layers of lead sulfide in his homemade system. And somehow working by intuition, he learned how much oxygen and how much sulfur to put in, and he made the best lead sulfide cells in the world. I was often asked whether I thought George had green fingers. And I said, no, I definitely knew he did not have green fingers. He had brown fingers because he was a chain smoker. He claimed this was necessary because he tested his cells by blowing on the cigarette ash and showing it to the layer that he was preparing. And from the change in the conductivity, he was able to see how far he'd gone in the processing.